Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host, Dan, radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Off the Grid in San Juan show. It's our salute to Puerto Rican medical students. I read an article about Puerto Rican medical students. We'll talk more about that in our first fractional portion. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. We are missing Shelly Irving, who has been dispatched to the Isomville Bureau We will have a traffic report from Isomville eventually. But back from Isomville now.
Can we just say there's three cars?
Of his post there from the University of Kentucky, Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to tell you how to access Health Matters and the Isomville traffic on the World Wide Web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. It's good to be back. You know, you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right, Morehead State Public Radio's website. Go there. Find Health Matters in the menu. Look at the list of shows. Again, it's only the more recent shows. And because we've been doing this for 15 years, we could not put them all up there. So anyway, find the most recent ones. Click on the little link there to listen to them. Listen to them over and over again. Send the links to your friends. Download them on your device. Keep them forever and ever. I say take a copy. Put them in your safety deposit box. I mean, they are that important.
Wow.
Right?
Commit them to memory.
I mean, here's the thing. I bet
and
you
then swallow the tape.
Neither one of us has a single one of them archived.
It's been a while. I just go to the site, and if I need one of the shows, I just go get it.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. What show is this? Like 820 something?
Yep.
Yeah, it's 820. It's 820 something. So anyway, audio of the show is WMKY.org. After that, you've made yourself mad. You want to say something about it. Go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and there you will find the fan page on Facebook. You can leave comments. You can like the page. You can read what we post out there. And it's sometimes can be an interesting conversation. We've got a few folks that are passionate about a few topics. It's pretty cool to watch and read. Again, but it's your chance to suggest show topics or feedback, or maybe that's where we'll post the traffic report. Maybe.
Now we gotta come up with an Isomville.
I said maybe. Maybe we'll give you a link to the Isomville webcam. Right? There's only one.
Well, of course.
And I'm hoping that John will let us use it.
Yeah.
So certainly go. If you want to interact with Health Matters, go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Vitamins and Minerals. And this is from Michael Pollan, Food Rules and Eater's Manual. Michael Pollan is a very sensible food guru. And he says about vitamins and minerals, he says, be the kind of person who takes supplements but then skip the supplements. That is, pay attention to what you are eating. Make sure that you are getting the essential things that you need. Be the kind of person who would take a supplement, but don't. That's Pollan's rules. I like that, so I put it in. I don't know why I need
right
to explain
up your alley.
It to you, Rick.
But I don't think you do that.
Self-explanatory.
Do you do that?
I do. Well, I certainly skip the supplements.
Well, I mean, heck, Tony, I skip the supplements.
Right, but I'm not sure I'm that kind of person.
I just pretend that M&Ms are supplements.
Okay, fair enough. That worked for me as well, with no doubt there's...
They look like pills.
Well,
right?
If you want something of no nutritional value.
Exactly.
They cost extra money.
And I feel good after I've done it.
Yeah. M&Ms, they give me strength and energy to do what... Never mind. This was in the AMA Journal, American Medical Association Journal, March 6th. It was a viewpoint, but it came from Joanne Manson and Sherry Basuk, who are with the Harvard Medical School Division of Preventive Medicine and Department of Epidemiology. And they're talking about supplements, vitamin and mineral supplements specifically. Here are some fun facts about vitamin and mineral supplements, when we'll talk about some key points in our second fractional portion. First of all, dietary supplementation, a $30 billion industry in the United States, more than 90,000 products on the market. Fun fact number two, 52% of U.S. adults report use of at least one supplement product, 10% report over four products. Fun fact number three, vitamins taken by 48% and minerals by 39% of adults, mainly to maintain their health and prevent disease rather than to treat any particular vitamin or mineral deficiency. Now, this is a key fun fact, which is number four, most randomized clinical trials. These are the best science that we can generate. Most randomized clinical trials of vitamin and mineral supplements have not demonstrated clear benefits, either for primary or secondary prevention. Primary being keep this thing from happening in the first place. Secondary, let's say you've had a heart attack or a stroke, try to prevent another one. Most clinical trials have not shown a clear benefit for any type of prevention from chronic diseases unless they're related to nutritional deficiency. So again, if you're deficient in a vitamin, you take the vitamin, that's going to work for you. Anything else, though, taking vitamins to make your heart stronger, to prevent arthritis, to protect your breathing, things like that, doesn't seem to work. And in fact, this is fun fact number five, some trials suggest that some supplements can be harmful. And then the fun fact number six, clinicians should counsel their patients. Supplementation is not a substitute for a healthful and balanced diet. And that leads to fun fact number seven. If you are able to balance your diet so that you get these supplements through your food, two things. One, all right, you got the vitamins, the minerals you need. And then two, you're eating healthy foods. Better to work hard on your diet, find dietary sources of whatever vitamin or supplement you're thinking about, rather than to put it in a pill form where it doesn't seem to show any benefit. We know that a healthy diet does give benefits.
Can I find most of those supplements in a McDonald's cheeseburger?
No, but you take the McDonald's cheeseburger and then you go get a chewable vitamin.
Let's be honest. My favorite's the Flintstones. I grew up with the Flintstones chewables.
Yeah.
That's what mom gave me.
Yeah, and you wonder how the Flintstones knew about vitamins and vitamin deficiencies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't get it. But
Bedrock was an advanced
civilization. It made me the man I am today.
Welcome back, Rick. Glad to have somebody there sitting.
I mean, for 2 weeks, you've not gotten this kind of fun.
Yeah.
I guarantee it.
All right. Let's go to our subject of the show today. This is medical students in Puerto Rico. And I don't want to make – this is not a telethon. This is not send money now. But I just wanted people to be aware. Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico September 20th, 2017. And for months afterwards, students lacked electricity, water, and a roof over their heads. And what happened then is, first of all, these were students. They did not have regular income. They spent a lot of their student loan money just getting food, just getting shelter, just getting the basics. Then deprived of that financial resource, in many cases they did not have the electricity to recharge their computers. They did not have internet access. And so these students have gotten behind in their studies. A lot of medical information now is on computer, less so on books. And even if they wanted to read the books, you can't get the books to the island of Puerto Rico. Now, as I said, this is not the great tragedy of Hurricane Maria, but what you realize is then that many people's lives were affected and continue to be affected. One of the things they mentioned is that in the case of, for instance, when Katrina hit New Orleans, Baylor College of Medicine opened its doors, classroom doors, to students from Tulane University and LSU so they could continue their studies, and the clinical students likewise got some help. In the case of Puerto Rico, we don't have an organized approach to help those students out. My comment on this, my understanding of this from the plight of the Puerto Rican students is, you know, what I always thought of disaster relief as coming from certain groups. The Red Cross would come in.
Sure.
The rescue squad would come in. Those people.
FEMA.
They had chainsaws. They had tents or trailers.
Or money
or food. But then you realize to really, after a disaster of the magnitude that struck Puerto Rico, we all can play a role. We can obviously can send money, but in the case of these medical students, I'm attending a medical meeting later this month, and I want to bring up, you know, we need to have a system where if a medical student's – because a doctor's really – these Puerto Rican doctors, that's very important to keep that next generation of doctors. You can't let them just fall off the map.
Right.
And so we owe it to medical students. We owe it to school kids. We owe it to those people that we can help to find ways to help our fellow person in these disasters. And to be honest, across the board, Puerto Rico has posed a big problem for those in the U.S. In terms of getting relief to those people who need it and trying to get some semblance of normal back to them. And I felt frustrated.
How do you do
this.
That then?
Well, in the case of medical schools, it's simply they're going to need functioning hospitals to do their clinical rotations. So if the medical school, if we had some centralized structure where they would be aware that there were three slots open in at the University of Kentucky or the University of Alabama or Tennessee, then these students would have the ability to continue their clinical training uninterrupted.
So are those slots that you keep open, or are they surge slots? So do you have a place that you can have a contract and say, okay, I can get housing, I can go rent this flat for, you know, 3 weeks and right. or a month and bring this rotation up here and immediately absorb it?
Well, keep in mind,
because it's a great idea.
I mean, the students sleeping, in many cases, they're living out of a suitcase, they're sleeping on a couch because everything they had has been destroyed by the hurricane. So you don't have to say there's a luxury apartment and a pre-programmed rotation. You said, I think we can take an extra student here in Knoxville, in Memphis, in Louisville, we'll work out something where you've got a dry place to stay, and already you're better than the situation they got
so,
now.
So so what if you took to me, we always talk about, and this is something that happens in business, right? I'm sure you've sat through these tabletop exercises where we talk about disasters, right? But the one thing that never gets mentioned in all of these disasters is, what are the people that are actually working at the business want to do most during a disaster? Go home?
Yeah.
Go home and take care of the disaster that's at home, right? I can't call my family. I can't get this. There are so many things that personally involve people during a disaster. It's very difficult to not think about that while you're trying to do the mission that you're paid to do. And, you know, and everybody's trying to do the right thing. It makes you wonder if in this case you take the doctors and offer them up a position, but you give them a week to get there so that they can kind of get some things straightened out, because right. you know good and well they want to get their dwelling at least secured.
We're talking about exams and we're talking about clinical rotations. Now, 6 months. I mean, it was September.
Sure.
It's 6 months out. And, the hospitals are functioning at still running at only part of capacity.
Sure.
And I would say in restoration of normal, IT infrastructure, which is your wheelhouse, that's going to be important. That's an important next step. Yeah, you need food. Yeah, you need shelter. But these students, one of the problems is if they're applying for a residency in the United States, internet access to be able to even put in the applications.
Interesting that you say that, because I think part of any, you know, disaster planning has changed dramatically over our lifetime, right, because of the IT influence and things. But if you think about it, you have a work life and you have a home life. Right. And so during a disaster, we obviously want to fix the business. Right. The business obviously wants to restore itself to a whole fashion. But the worker also wants to restore their home life. So DR plans now almost have to include a way to spin up. Like, so say we lose an enterprise system like what manages your paychecks. So when we spin that back up, we want to spin that up in a cloud environment that's not part of where the disaster is and make it accessible from somebody who finally gets their home fixed. Now they can actually work from home while they're still tending to their home functions. It's kind of a best of both worlds. So I think any good disaster plan makes it that the next time you access the system in that disaster scenario is from somewhere else, you know, at home. And I don't know, it's an interesting exercise to go through. But it's interesting to see how to do this for the medical students.
Yeah, and I think what I realize is that we can all play a role and a bigger role than we're currently playing. We're going to go off and play something else because we've got a break.
It's probably banjo music.
Yep. Come back for our second fractional portion of listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Off the Grid in San Juan show. It is our salute to the medical students of Puerto Rico and a reminder to all of us that disaster relief and disaster recovery is not just simply one group or one person's job. We all bear a role. We need to look out for each other. And if we are right, these natural disasters are going to be more frequent in the future. It would be nice to be able to lend a hand because we may, in fact, need one someday. Our sponsor, Vitamins and Minerals, reminding you, Michael Pollan, food expert, said, be the kind of person who takes supplements but then skip the supplements. Here are, according again to the authors from Harvard and the AMA Journal in March of 2018 on March 6th, for pregnancy, I think we all are aware of this. Folic acid and prenatal vitamins, very, very handy for pregnancy. Folic acid prevents something called neural tube defects. These are some pretty severe birth defects, and that would be a good thing to do. So for women who are considering having children, or certainly for women who are pregnant, folic acid, a very handy thing. Infants and children, if you're breastfed, vitamin D until you're weaned. Iron from ages 4 to 6 months. Midlife and older adults, some people may benefit from supplemental vitamin B12. The Weaver household, it is difficult to tell that you are about to get low in vitamin 12. We supplement vitamin B12. Vitamin D or calcium because we all, our bones get more brittle as we get older. The Weavers are on vitamin D and calcium as well. In high-risk subgroups, if you have conditions that interfere with absorption, something like you have bariatric surgery, that is, you have one of the intestinal bypasses. The fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, B vitamins, iron, calcium, zinc, copper, multivitamins, multiminerals, if you interfere with the production of stomach acid, you will get deficient in those. If you have a condition called pernicious anemia, that is, by definition, a vitamin B12 problem. If you have inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease, iron, B vitamins, vitamin D, zinc, and magnesium. So in any of these cases, if it interferes with absorption, vitamin B12 is very, very critically dependent on how well you absorb foods from your gut and is likely to go deficient. So that's one of the reasons why we supplement B12 is because it is really very easy to have difficulty absorbing B vitamins. If you have osteoporosis, vitamin D, calcium, and magnesium, if you're on long-term use of acid-blocking medicines, such as the purple pill, once again, vitamin B12, calcium, magnesium, and if you're taking metformin for your diabetes, you are higher risk of becoming deficient in vitamin B12. So those are some specific examples, specific populations we're trying to watch for vitamins. As a whole, though, multivitamin supplementation, vitamin supplementation in the population, not shown to prevent any disease.
But it doesn't change the way the Flintstones taste.
Flintstones taste good. Sometimes you just have a hankering for that chewy Flintstone vitamin.
The Flintstone vitamin isn't really chewy. It's more like one of the sour,
sweet tarts?
It's like a sweet tart more thing. But the gummy bears are kind of chewy.
Gummy bear. See, I'm not a gummy bear person. I grew up before gummy bears, and gummy bears are just annoying. And
well, so did I, but even I can adapt to change, don't I?
Really? No.
Come on, man. You're missing out on some good candy.
I'll tell you what, Necco wafers.
I love Necco wafers. You can only get those at Cracker Barrel. Those are really...
This is antique candy.
This segment brought to you by
Necco wafers. All right, speaking of rough, very nice segue. New England Journal of Medicine, March 8th. Management of a heart attack, it's called an inferior ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. That is a heart attack. And the interesting thing was the way it was managed. This was a 44-year-old man who had severe chest pain and dizziness, and he went to the nursing station in Coral Bay, Australia. Now, there's two things that you need to know about the nursing station in Coral Bay, Australia. One, it's more than 1,000 kilometers from Perth and 150 kilometers from the next nearest medical facility. The second thing is, this 44-year-old man was the only healthcare provider working at that nursing station. He was by himself. He comes in. He has severe chest pain and dizziness. He runs an EKG, and it's the big one.
Uh-oh.
There was something called third-degree heart block, and that is ugly. That is real. That is a major problem. So he starts an IV. He gives himself aspirin, Plavix, nitroglycerin, some blood thinner called heparin, and then he gets ready to give a clot-busting drug to himself. He mixes it up and so forth, and he gives himself the clot-busting drug. Meanwhile, he put the defibrillator pads and prepared a bunch of emergency drugs in case things went really bad, because sometimes when you use the clot-busting drugs, you can get some bad heart rhythms. And just to top it off, he gave himself a little morphine.
Uh-oh.
Morphine used to be used for heart. It's not bad for your heart. It may be a little bit good for your heart, and we do use it to relieve pain and heart attacks. On the other hand, if I were busy putting together these things and thinking I might have to actually shock my own heart, I think I would leave off the morphine. Maybe I should add the morphine. I believe if I gave myself morphine, even a small amount of morphine, I probably would wake up 6 hours later with either a completed heart attack or I wouldn't wake up at all. I don't know. I would have trouble with it. But he did. He gave himself some morphine. Got there. And actually, the clot-busting medicine worked. He had already dialed the flying doctor service to a cardiology unit. He was flown there, and he had a heart cath the next day, which, in fact, worked. Now, the point of this is, in Western Australia, 2.5 million square kilometers, very sparsely populated, obviously, and they developed a telephonic system, a telemedicine system, with access to cardiologists, and this guy took advantage of that and was brave enough to start his own IV and start his own medicines and give himself a clot-busting drug.
Oh, my goodness.
Tough. You can imagine, I mean, when you're slapping a defibrillator pad on yourself, then you're entering James Bond territory. It's only a few people that have survived a successful defibrillator. I do remember, I believe, James Bond defibrillated himself in the car and then went back in and finished a high-stakes poker game.
I've told the story on air a couple times where I defibrillated myself one time. Let's just leave it. I was pretending to be James Bond.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of James Bond involved.
No. Hey, and I'm not sure there's a whole lot of intent involved either. Was this an accidental defibrillation?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, it wasn't accidental. I mean, I knew what I was doing. I was just an idiot. I mean, you know.
It was an accidental idiot.
Sure. Yeah, well, I was 18 years old. I was working in the Army. I was testing. I would go around and test medical devices. Well, one of them was a defibrillator. And so you used to have to load test them, right?
Yeah.
And so you'd have to do 10 shots, 10 discharges at full power. And on about discharge number 7, I got a little careless, and my thumbs actually got across the paddles while I was putting it on the test gear.
That'll make you think.
The next day, my teeth hurt. There wasn't anything about me that, I mean, just think about every muscle in your body contracting at the same time.
Electro Rick will be signing autographs after the show. Here's one that has been intensely praised by some of the review services that I use. It is a fascinating idea, and it's one that you can put into immediate application. Our Health Matters listeners could do this afternoon. It's that fast. This was March 9th. This was the study was reported in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, but it was a presentation from a meeting, an emergency medicine meeting. And so it's not been reviewed, and that's the thing that bothers them, but it was very well done. They took 120 adult emergency room patients who came in with nausea or vomiting. And these were people that were not dehydrated, did not need IV access. And these 120 people, they had three things you could do. One is you use 4-milligram pill of Zofran. Zofran's a real standard anti-nausea medicine. We use it a lot of times for people getting chemotherapy, for people who've been through operations and so forth. And you could take a 4-milligram pill of Zofran. The next thing they did was really odd. They took an alcohol prep pad in the packet, and they ripped it open, and you sniffed the isopropyl alcohol.
Well, that's, yeah.
Yeah. The third thing is, and you took a pill, which was a sugar pill. It was a Flintstone vitamin or something. I don't know what it was. And then the third thing you did, you sniffed the alcohol and you took a Zofran pill. You sniffed alcohol and took a sugar pill, or you took the Zofran pill and sniffed water. Okay. Three groups. You sniff something, you take something. And the sniff thing is either alcohol or water. The take is either a 4-milligram pill or a sugar pill.
Okay.
All right. It turns out that your nausea score dropped by 30 points in the alcohol plus Zofran group, dropped by 32 points in the alcohol group, and by 9 points in the Zofran alone group. And they had to give extra medicines to 28% of the alcohol Zofran group, 25% of the alcohol only, and 45% of the people who just got the Zofran. So up until this point, if you came with nausea, they'd say, why don't you try this anti-nausea medicine called Zofran and see if that helps you? And 45% of the time, you're going to have to get something else. The alternative is rip open an alcohol pad and sniff on it. And you can take two or three and sniff on them if you want to. And that, no one knows the mechanism, but that may quiet your nausea down.
That doesn't seem right. And let me ask you something. Can you do it with bourbon?
You know, can all right. Because
that's alcohol.
Yeah, that's alcohol. What if you just got a bottle of alcohol and just held it up your nose? Let's forget that. I mean, this is what they did, though. They ripped open an alcohol pad and sniffed it. And so I will just say this.
Who dreams this stuff up?
Well, I suppose somebody observed it. Now, I will tell you, there was an emergency room physician at St. Clair. I mentioned this to her, and she said, yeah, they tried to convince me after my surgery that it would, that inhaling alcohol would help, but it didn't. And so I'm not saying this is perfect, but I'm saying that's a pretty cheap, pretty simple thing to do if you're nauseated.
But as a doctor, you're perceived as being a guy who's really smart, right? Don't you hope your patient think you're really smart?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you really think you're really smart by telling them to really sniff on the – here, take this alcohol pad and have a sniff.
120
people.
Does
that make you sound smart?
Three groups of 40.
I'm not
arguing
with that.
Had the condition that they have and got better. Well, and I suppose you're thinking, well, look, sniffing alcohol, not a good idea.
Couldn't we put it in a different container and make it cost more and look important?
Yeah. I mean, well, and
it just
might.
Seems like a lens.
And so much of that involves the mind, involves thinking. You know, your mind helps you heal.
Well, we're conditioned
so
to
think more than that. Yeah, so if you had this really expensive thing that you sniffed on, and you weren't sure what was in it, and maybe it had a little menthol or something, you might be more likely to believe it. It might actually work better because you would help it work better. But I think I certainly, if I get real nauseated, I think I may sniff a little alcohol and
see what
happens.
Now you've offered up so many questions. How about we do an actual what is the study where
the randomized study?
Not a randomized, the next one, where you look at correlation studies.
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where you look at the statistical, how many people who have size 15 shoes or NBA
right,
players.
Right, observational studies.
Right, observational studies. So what if we just say, okay, people who smoke regular cigarettes get nausea X amount of time, and people who smoke menthol cigarettes get nauseated less.
Yeah. Now, see, they did not observe whether or not people close to the alcohol bottles in the emergency room were less nauseated. What they did was they divided people up. It's a strong study, well executed, 120 people. It's published in an abstract form at a meeting rather than being in the bulk of the journal, but it sure makes you look. And the other thing is, it's hard to argue against ripping open an alcohol pad. That is a very nice, very safe thing to do. It's hard to get.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. When you're done, you can wipe off your glasses.
Yeah, something like that. So it looked like a good idea. I'm gonna start this segment, and then we'll have to carry it through to next time because I wanted to get Rick's thoughts on this. This was actually from Las Vegas, March 7th. So you were in the territory.
There. I was there. Yeah. Yes, I was there.
And this is HIMSS 18.
Right, HIMSS.
Yeah,
this you can say HIMSS. It's okay.
Health Innovation Leaders Summit.
Right. It's a breakout to the Health Information Management Systems.
Right.
Meeting.
So these are the thought leaders, the people who are leading us into the new world of health innovation, and a lot of it is electronic stuff.
We always call it healthcare IT meeting.
Okay. There were two people: Health Castlight Health President Derek Newell, Fitbit Health Solutions Chief Operating Officer Amy McDonald, and United Healthcare Vice President of Emerging Products, which is a great term, Paul Sterling. And they were talking about wearable technology. They said, look, connected devices are interesting. They're gadgets, and they're interesting. And what we want to do is leverage that to make them a health tool. So these are baby steps. But what United Health did was they paid users $4 a day to meet certain health and wellness goals as measured by their tracker. And that might be a Fitbit, a Samsung device, or an Apple Watch, or something like that. So you hit your targets on your wearable health device. You get paid an extra $4 a day. And the first you get a subsidy to help you buy the device and so forth. And so, again, it sounds paternalistic. Your employer's telling you what your heart rate or your number of steps per day should be. They're interfering. They're really reaching down in your life. But the idea is we can make these small behavioral changes that may promote health.
Right. I mean, that's what the whole wearable concept is, isn't it? I mean, you're trying to basically inform yourself enough to where you either feel guilty or motivated to change something.
Yeah. I wish, I really wish. I mean, we've got 120 people who sniff alcohol and have less nausea. I really wish I could see one of these programs and see the data that says these employees have a lower blood pressure, they're on less medications, they've lost 20 pounds.
Well, but isn't this study, isn't this particular scenario a good study? You know, because the people that are doing it aren't necessarily doing it because they're wealthy or can afford the wearable or because they think it's the right thing to do. I mean, it's really kind of monetarily incentivized, right?
Right. And the idea is,
so it's going to get a bigger audience.
This is kind of a proof of concept. Can we get people to hit these targets? Now, once we figure that out, we'll see if hitting these targets makes a difference.
Right.
You'd like to do it the other way around. I'd like to have you do, if I'm going to go in and tell you how many steps to take, I would like to base that on the fact that I have evidence, I have data that says that this number of steps is actually healthier. And you have to watch this. Again, like we talked about with observational studies, the people that walk more are going to be healthier, but that does not mean that we could take an unhealthy person and get them started walking.
Right.
That's still something that we don't really know. It may be that the reason they don't walk more is because they have arthritis or some other condition, and as soon as we start them walking, they're in fact going to make themselves worse rather than better. So they're trying to sort of jump ahead of the science and see if we are able to make them walk more and then work backwards and see whether or not walking more actually helps. It's valid, but it is a little frustrating that we're spending that time.
Well, and let's be honest, the wearable really needs to get to a state where it's more than just walking, right? It really kind of – they need to get to a point where if you're diabetic, it can tell you your blood sugar. There's things that it needs to be able to tell you beyond just – I've taken 7,000 steps. You need 3,000 more before you can go to bed. I'm going to keep pulsating so that you can't go to bed.
At that point, the Fitbit's going to go in the drawer. There's just no doubt about that.
It needs to start providing us with more data that's relevant to our health and not just the number of steps. Now, I get it. Activity is important, right? Steps are important. When I was at HIMSS last week, I averaged about 15,000 steps a day, which for me is more than double what my normal step count is.
That's your watch told you that?
Well, yeah, my Blaze. Mm-hmm. It's a Fitbit Blaze, but yeah, it's a activity tracker. One day I got near 20,000. I walked 9 miles one day at this conference,
Now, the question is going to be, does knowing that number –
does it make me order a bigger steak for dinner? Yes,
right. You
absolutely.
Think, gee whiz, I've done that, so I should eat more. Or does that in fact say, you say, all right, this felt good today.
28-ounce ribeye, tomahawk style, bone in. Yes, I did well that night for dinner. So, think about that during the break.
Yeah, for our radio fans, talk amongst yourselves while we resort these research priorities, and we'll come back. And for some reason, we're going to talk some more. Stay tuned for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm not even going to start.
You have yet to calm down.
You use your Fitbit to clear the way so you can have a steak.
Truth be known, Tony, I didn't look at my Fitbit and go, yep, I'm ordering the ribeye.
But once you ordered the ribeye, you looked at you and said, hey, I deserve this.
It was a nice coincidence.
This is the off-the-grid.
But I had walked 9 miles. I was actually kind of hungry.
I understand. But if a healthy habit is just simply a license to do an unhealthy thing.
Well, so eating a ribeye is unhealthy?
How big was the ribeye again? Do you want to keep going with this?
Well, I never said how much of it I ate.
That's true. The ribeye was 28 ounces.
Bone in.
So we could probably get it down to
maybe. And the tomahawk has a big old bone in it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's only.
So it was probably 8, 9 ounces after the.
8 or 9? Or. That was one heck of a bone.
It was a pretty big bone. And I'm at this point, I'm going to beat you with it. We keep talking about it.
This is Off the Grid and Sam Wan Show. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver.
And we are Off the Grid.
Our sponsor for the final time, vitamin and mineral supplements, what clinicians need to know. So if you're not eating 20 ounces or more of steak a day, what about those vitamins? A couple of things that points that I want to make from the AMA Journal on March 6th. This is from Harvard, the Division of Preventive Medicine and the Department of Epidemiology. First of all, realize that there are no clinical trials that show a clear benefit for vitamins or minerals in preventing chronic diseases, except deficiencies of those vitamins and minerals. And then secondly, some vitamins and minerals, beta-carotene, high doses of folic acid, vitamin E, selenium, can have harmful effects. The other thing from this editorial, multivitamin, multimineral supplementation not recommended for generally healthy U.S. adults. One large trial in U.S. men showed a modest lowering of cancer risk, but the results, really, we need to see those in other trials to allow for analysis. And finally, FDA is not authorized to review dietary supplements. In fact, Congress has steered dietary supplements away from the FDA. So when you get a dietary supplement or a multivitamin, it is loosely describes what's in the vitamin, but that does not mean that you absorb everything that's in the vitamin, and it does not mean that that vitamin is going to contain the same amounts of whatever those things are as another lot, another batch. They do try to standardize when they do these clinical trials. They try to get high-end vitamins and supplements that are standardized. And I regret instantly I said high-end, because it turns out that expensive vitamins and minerals are not necessarily safer or better than cheaper vitamins or minerals. We have a real problem.
But they're more gummy or more sweet tarty.
Yeah, they are better packaged, maybe a little bit more tasty, and they are backed by large amounts of advertising.
And they probably have some beautiful graphics on them.
Wonderful. That's our sponsor, Vitamin Mineral Supplements. Remember, be the kind of person who takes supplements but then skip the supplements, according to Michael Pollan. Now, let's go back to where we were before Rick completely derailed the arguments. The idea is, what if we equip people with some type of health tracking device, and Fitbit's one of the classic prototypes of a health tracking device. What if we did that? And United Health said that. They said, we'll help you buy it, and then we're going to set targets, and we will pay you to hit those targets. And this is, again, they're not looking right now at whether or not people then had lower rates of diabetes, lower rates of stroke, better blood pressure control, or anything like that. They're just saying, can we do this? And then if we can pay you, then is there something we could track that actually would help make you a healthier person?
Well, I don't know that they necessarily can pay you, but what they probably could do is they probably could lower your insurance. Because if you think about it, it's very similar to putting a device on your car for your car insurance.
Well, I'll give you the other side of this, and this is from Andy Slavitt. Andy Slavitt is the former Medicare and Medicaid chief. He was the commissioner of Medicare and Medicaid. And when the Republican lawmakers were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, he actually did town halls across the country. He went to Cleveland, Reno, places like that, broke down the policies, and talked about what the Affordable Care Act did and didn't do. It is not our favorite piece of legislation. It has had some beneficial effects. And Andy Slavitt was there to talk about both the benefits and the drawbacks to the Affordable Care Act, because, again, at the time, no one else was actually talking about it. So simply just kind of sloganing the idea that they would repeal it. Now, Andy Slavitt is now an entrepreneur. He is investing in healthcare, and this is what Andy Slavitt says, and I want our radio fans to hear this. We need to stop investing in the third Fitbit for the 50-year-old upper-class person and start innovating for people who have common diseases and conditions but live in communities with low access to care. That is, this idea of taking employees, granted you have control over employees, you can make them do what you want. Granted, you can use these devices, and of course, people will be happy to sell you these devices, but he says, we need to learn to manage chronic illness. And he says, look, we start with the oldest and sickest people in America. He was disturbed while he was running the Center for Medicare and Medicaid. he was disturbed by the fact that that we spent so much of our attention on that. He is investing in something called CityBlock, which is supposed to help low-income Americans with costly and complex needs, including housing support and medicines. Now, the idea is if you can find more economical ways to manage chronic disease in these low-income populations, you will save a lot of money on health care. If you do the Fitbit for the employees, an employer, so far we haven't found a way an employer will save money on health care. There is an idea that they might. But we could save a ton of money collectively if we took better care of our poorest, our sickest, our oldest people.
Is it just that we don't have enough data on, you know, the whole, you know, people with the wearable, or is it I just wonder if it's just the jury's still out on that.
Well, I know, and let me just say, in all honesty, Rick has devoted his life to developing technology, and you hope that technology could solve some of these problems.
Well, there has to be something valuable in the data. It's just hard to correlate right now, right? So, and maybe what it is the wearable doesn't correlate to you, Tony, but it maybe everybody in Moorheads translates to a systemic problem.
Yeah.
You know, when you roll the data up into really big numbers, it actually, you can see patterns and trends and actually correlate it to something that's really wrong.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is, you know, how much is healthcare? It's pretty expensive, right?
Yes.
In general, healthcare is pretty expensive. If everybody was in their first hospital stay or the first doctor's visit or whatever is given some type of a wearable device as part of their healthcare, how is that going to dramatically increase what we're spending on healthcare? And not provide with valuable data for the insurance companies and for the medical providers and for the patients themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, we're assuming this gentleman, and I don't necessarily disagree with him because there is a socioeconomic standard associated with people who can afford to wear a $100 Fitbit, right? I mean, there's something that goes along with that. But they're not completely useless devices. We just haven't quite figured out how to use the data from them yet.
And the question becomes then, do we invest in that to try to show that that technology works, which is a reasonable thing. It's not an unreasonable thing to do, but
well, we're still taking taking vitamins.
Yeah.
I mean, so how is a, you know, I mean,
it's not like what there aren't other things that where we're, I mean, in the case of vitamins, we see no clear benefit. They've been around for a long time, and it does not appear that they are a benefit. As a matter of fact, they may be harmful, and they're also distracting us from a healthy diet. So there are many reasons not to spend our money there, whereas wearables have a potential for improvement and probably a low potential for harm, although they are costly. His point is, let's focus our attention not on the employees, certainly not on the executives, but let's go for the older, sicker people. Let's put our attention there. Let's focus our technology and everything else on trying to help them, because this is where we are spending most of our healthcare dollars, and some small improvements could make a tremendous change in our overall healthcare burden. Our problem is, you know, we don't, it's just like the Puerto Rican medical students, those are not the people you see every day, and it really is hard to concern yourself with someone you're not confronted with daily. So in that sense, you'd rather take care of your own health, your employees' health, the people you know, rather than some of those other people. I hope we will still have the decency to help out those people. Like I said, if we consider we're all in this together, then that would be important. And I liked Andy Slavitt's approach, just to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he's not wrong. It's just there are many viewpoints to this argument.
Fair enough. Here, speaking of an argument, this was March 5th, the Annals of Internal Medicine, and this is pretty important for our diabetic patients. So if you have someone who has diabetes, please get them closer to the radio so they can hear this. From the American College of Physicians, the American College of Physicians has bravely put out guidelines for treatment of high blood pressure and now diabetes that are at odds with the specialty societies. And one of the things they've done is what we call de-escalation. They've simply said, look, let's back it down to what we know scientifically we can do. And benefit people rather than continuing to push for an escalation, newer drugs, lower targets, more monitoring, and so forth. And so here are their guidelines for management of diabetes. Number one, you need to personalize your goal for sugar control in people with type 2 diabetes based on benefits and harms of it, and also the patient's preference and their general healthcare and life expectancy. No arguments there. Personalization, everyone agrees. Statement two, this is where it starts to get dicey. Clinicians should aim to achieve an A1C level between 7% and 8% in most patients, with type 2 diabetes.
That's pretty high, isn't it?
Yeah, the American Diabetes Association, they said below 7%. They've been talking below 6.5%. And the higher it is, the higher the average sugar is. The American College of Physicians says, look, you're going to make a lot of people have low blood sugar. The benefits are very small. We feel comfortable at 7 to 8%. We don't want you to chase 6.5%, adding more medicines and taking a risk of a low blood sugar. That is, as I said, the American Diabetes Association not happy with that. Statement three. Clinicians should consider de-intensifying drug therapy in people who have A1C levels less than 6.5%. According to the American Diabetes Association, perfect. You finally got them where they need to be. According to the American College of Physicians, you're using too much drugs if you get them to that level. Let it float up. Use less drugs. Save the patient's money.
Just hearing about this and just the way that the tone and pitch and inflection of your voice and listening to you, this seems like they're just being a little more reasonable.
Well, they did the same thing with high blood pressure. When the American Heart Association came out with guidelines saying, look, we've got to go below 130 instead of 140. We've got to get the blood pressure down below 80 instead of below 90. They came back and said, look, if you're over age 60, 150, less than 150 is fine. And they've taken a lot of heat for that. But they're saying, look, the evidence here, I understand that you may be able to do more things for your heart at a 130 or less. But there are other things besides your heart we have to consider. Risk of falls, medication costs, monitoring costs. And overall, we believe that for older patients, you can let the blood pressure float up more. They're saying essentially the same thing about diabetes. It is, and it's about time we had this conversation of how far do we want to go.
I mean, I remember when we went from 6.5 to 7 on the A1C value, right? So, I mean, that seemed like a lot at the time. But this was 7 to 8 or less than 6.5.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a slot limit for your diabetes.
Yeah, and so you ask yourself, you know, and understand the debate's still going on. Your doctor, your healthcare provider is going to have an opinion on this, but I want you to realize the American College of Physicians says, let's individualize it. If you are gung-ho, you're worried about the complications, you're a young person, you're able to monitor your sugars, then you can go to a tighter level. You want to personalize this, but that we're not saying for everyone under every circumstances we need to aim for less than 6.5 or even less than 7. 7 to 8 for many middle-aged people with type 2 diabetes is going to be good. The American Diabetes Association says, look, we've got all these drugs now, the new drugs, they can lower your risk of heart disease and all sorts of other stuff, so we should do that. The American College of Physicians says, look, treat the cholesterol, treat the blood pressure, that's fine. But the sugar is not, you're not going to use the sugar to try to get at lower heart rates of heart disease. That's not the purpose of treating diabetes.
Yeah.
We'll keep the try to keep the sugar under control. Kind of exciting, and we're going to, Rick and I are going to argue this thing out when we get to our last segment. And sort of to support this, this came out of something called TransUnion Healthcare, March 5th, and I read it in a summary. They said nearly half of patients' out-of-pocket costs per healthcare visit were lower than $500 in 2017. 39% were $500 to $1,000 and 12% over $1,000. The average out-of-pocket healthcare costs, the average, has risen to $1,800 per year. And so we have to find a way to make medical care more affordable. And
there's a topic we've never talked about.
Yeah. And so part of it is, look, you've got all these guidelines. Add more medicines. Take more tests. Do more monitoring.
And what we call in the industry is a standard of care. The standard of care keeps adding these things to make – I mean, that's why you get a regimen of tests. That's why you get, you know, 16 different x-rays, right?
Right.
I mean, that's because they're trying to hit a standard of care that's been established that may – of those 16 images, one of them may show them what they want.
Right.
But if you miss it – uh-oh. This is a catch-22, Tony.
It is because if managing high blood pressure and managing sugar, we do this as healthcare providers and as patients hoping to get a benefit 5 years, 10 years down the road. And whether we manage it or tightly or loose, obviously if you get hit by a truck, then you should have eaten cake.
Trying to spend less on health care is what everybody wants to do until it's them or their parents or their family.
Right. And in this case, certainly if you ran into trouble, you had some complication of your diabetes or a stroke related to your high blood pressure, you would have wished you would have gone back and treated more aggressively if we go with these lower targets. But they can save money. And
or eat the chocolate cake.
Right. And the American College of Physicians, they said they believe that that they actually that you can get similar reductions in your overall mortality with a less aggressive approach. Kind of an exciting time, and stay tuned. We'll see who wins the war on these different guidelines.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook, just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thank you for listening to our show. And remember, these arguments on diabetes control from the editorials of the American College of Physicians and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists.
Health Matters believes that lifestyle modification with diet and exercise remains at the forefront of diabetes care. If patients can achieve lower targets for their sugar with diet and exercise, then that's absolutely the target. Lifestyle changes do not harm patients or cause side effects. Health Matters is concerned that there are harms associated with more rigorous blood sugar targets. Two studies show exactly that. One study showed that patients treated intensively had an increase in all-cause mortality, as well as an increase in cardiovascular mortality and an increase in episodes of low blood sugar.
Look, 30 million people have diabetes. 1 out of 3 Medicare dollars is spent on diabetes. We cannot take an approach that should loosen our targets at this point. In fact, we have opportunities to intensify the targets. Low blood sugar can be managed with accurate monitoring devices. We believe Health Matters is going in the wrong direction. The right direction is work to actively manage patients to a tight goal to decrease complications.
In coming out with statements that our targets for diabetes may be less intense compared with other groups, Health Matters is not saying that diabetes should not be carefully managed. What we are saying is that for patient safety, for decreasing cost, and for maximizing benefits, most targets should be higher.
Whatever your targets, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.